Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Book Spider podcast, a podcast in which I, Chris Malmberg, and my co-hosts Patrick Barney and Hans Berger say hello, boys.
I'm Patrick.
I'm Hans.
Those were not hellos, but we talk about the books that we've read and really try to get super, super dry about it, like the best kind of sex, as dry as possible. today is part three of a three-parter in which we've been moving our way through Don DeLillo's Underworld. If you haven't listened to parts one and two, I suggest you do so, because this is already a complicated book to talk about when you've read it. I can't imagine that it's super pleasant to listen to a conversation that you haven't heard the first part of about a novel like Underworld.
So basically, the end section of Underworld, there are kind of two ending sections of Underworld that we read and are talking about today. And the first of those is called Arrangement in Gray and Black. It is the portion that covers the very chronological beginning of all the action in the novel. And it follows Nick Shea, Matt Shea, Alfred Bronzini, the Clara Sachs, kind of the four of the viewpoint characters from throughout the novel. It rotates between their perspectives during the segment of time right before Nick commits the manslaughter, the accidental murder that changes the course of his life. And it follows the beginnings of what might have been on Nick's part a descent into sort of a life of crime or a gangster mentality. He steals cars, he gets in fights, there's some hint that perhaps he's done a robbery, though that's somewhat elliptically suggested. And he's friends with a gentleman named George Monza, who is seems like a heroin addict more so than a casual user. And that section of the novel follows all of their lives in, I think, somewhat more of an orderly, linear manner than we've had for quite some time. I talked yesterday, or not yesterday, in the last episode I talked about the way that the switches between times and places accelerate as the novel kind of hurtles forward, and there's a kind of a calming effect here, right, where we come to a much more kind of stable period. And the novel, of course, ends with Nick somewhat accidentally shooting George Monza and being taken away, which thereby sets in motion the whole arc of his life, really. And there's then an epilogue, which jumps all the way forward to the chronological end of the novel, where Nick is in Kazakhstan. He's observing the demonstration of a new form of waste disposal, wherein toxic or hazardous waste, such as but not necessarily limited to nuclear waste, in which is basically buried underground and incinerated with an atomic explosion. And then he's shown a village nearby that is full of Kazakhstani people who have been terribly deformed by living next to decades of atomic testing, and confronts Brian Glasic about having an affair with his wife. The final portion of the novel follows the nun's sister, Edgar. There was a section much, much, much earlier, like 500 pages ago, where Sister Edgar was trying to track down a homeless girl named Esmeralda. In this section, we discover that Esmeralda has been rather brutally murdered, but there is a possibly miraculous event that occurs wherein her face is displayed on a billboard when a train's lights go by it. Sister Edgar takes some comfort from this miracle, even though it only lasts for a couple days before the billboard is taken down. And at the very end of the novel, Sister Edgar dies, and the last couple of pages show her in cyberspace, fusing it with everything, because everything is connected in cyberspace. Among other things, kind of uniting with J. Edgar Hoover, the other Edgar of the novel, and then witnessing kind of as you witnessing the collective digital memory of an atomic test. And the final paragraph is the reader addressed in second person looking at a word on a computer monitor, hearing sounds of children outside and pondering the word, and the word is peace. So that is a much more detailed synopsis, actually, than we've generally been giving, right? Because this is, in most ways, a pretty synopsis-proof novel. You know, there are a couple of big events that dominate it, and many, many, many kind of threads of those events, repercussions of those events. But for the most part, I mean, to just say this happens, this happens, this happens, it's really not a particularly... the novel does not lend itself to that, right? It's more just kind of a jumble of images, moments, ideas, vignettes. It's a very vignette-oriented novel. More so as it goes along, but in these last couple of sections, like I said a minute ago, I think some of that chaotic jumble of vignettes kind of recedes, right? And we have a somewhat calmer and more focused ending, which can be summarized reasonably well. So
that actually bridges into a question that I had, and I believe you had said before, Hans, that in another episode on this book, that you don't think of this book as a postmodern novel. Is that right?
No, I think what I said is that DeLillo is generally considered to be a postmodern author, but that in many ways he actually... I've said in the past, and I think Patrick has made a good counterargument to this, but I've said in the past that I think of DeLillo as being someone who writes about the postmodern condition while not endorsing it, right? He's not an author who... He's an author who does not take the side of postmodern thought, right? He's more someone who writes about the postmodern condition from really kind of a more classically humanist perspective, in ways which are critical of the mental habits of postmodernism.
To clarify, I only brought up the argument about DeLillo seeming to endorse the postmodern view of history. So maybe not everything. It just pertained to history.
No. Just pertaining to history, right? I think like the postmodern view of morality, the idea of kind of the, I think DeLillo in many ways is actually a fairly conservative person. Not like he's a small C conservative person. I don't think that he would like, he's probably, I don't know, like on the left of the American political spectrum. Right. But I think that he's someone who actually, there's a pretty clear reverence, I think, in particular for the Catholic Church here and in other novels, the way that nuns and Catholicism and religion are treated is actually, there's a kind of a sense of reverence for and attachment to kind of older ways of thinking and being, right? And something like, you know, White Noise is an extended critique of the hollowness of surface level material culture and what, you know, DeLillo saw as kind of the vacuousness of consumer pop culture in the 80s. And I keep coming back to White Noise because it's so much easier to parse than this novel, and it's easier to kind of, I think in some ways, if you read White Noise and you get a sense from that of what DeLillo values and doesn't value, it makes it somewhat easier to tell how to make sense of this. But there is a lot of overlap in terms of themes and imagery, right? But like, you know, white noise, basically pop culture is vacuous. Modern pop academia is vacuous. Consumerism is vacuous. The only thing that's treated with any kind of, the only thing that seems to have any gravity or meaning there basically is the church and nuns. And some of the same thing is true here, actually. Not so much because I don't think that DeLillo like literally, he's described himself as a cultural Catholic, right? That he's not somebody who literally believes in those things, but he's someone who sees the grounding force of tradition and contemplation as an important counterweight to the postmodern condition. Sorry, go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, I was while we're talking about or making comparisons with White Noise, the ending of this novel and the ending of White Noise are essentially the same. Like the protagonist confronts a spouse about infidelity, and then there's this kind of performative show of dominance. I believe both the protagonist of White Noise and Nick Shay hit the person who has been sleeping with their spouse, and then the spouses, they reconcile with their spouses. And I was wondering if you said he's a conservative with a small, DeLillo is a conservative with a small C. I wonder if there's anything we can read into with these similar endings in relation to this like small C conservative or cultural Catholicism that he has.
Well, there's probably a value there in forgiveness and stability, right? In choosing to kind of keep the wholeness of the family, in choosing to continue to honor commitments like marriage, even if they're carried out imperfectly or you have to forgive things to do so. That seems to me to be in keeping with the kind of occasional flashes that you get of he seems like there's a way that these books portray chaos and in the process kind of suggest the value of stability and order and the reconciled marriages, the forgiving of infidelity, that seems to me to be very in line with that. Catholics, of course, famously don't like divorce, right? Like, technically, you can't get divorced in the Catholic Church. You can only have an annulment. There's a big difference between, you know, theory and practice there.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's a really good point about the overlapping endings of White Noise and Underworld. And, I mean, you know, people who are critical of Underworld, I think one thing that they are critical of, not perhaps unfairly, is the ways in which it becomes a little bit repetitive of things from other DeLillo novels. Mm. Some of the kind of plot arc of Nick Shay and Jack Gladney overlapping in the ways that you describe, some thematic
that's
similarities. Yeah. Jack Gladney, that's the White Noise.
Yeah.
So, like, about that reconciliation with Marion, Nick has this line that I'm going to butcher. So I'm just going to try to summarize it. He hadn't told her about the manslaughter or his time. I don't think his time in juvie either. In all the time that they had been married. But we learn after he confronts Brian that, at least from his perspective, their relationship is better than ever, him and Marion's. And he is telling her about this past that he had avoided telling her about. And this line just sort of like jumped out at me where he says something along the lines that of her seeing his past and learning kind of the sequence of events that led to who he is, because he doesn't really know what happened. And there's a really interesting sort of paradox there where, like, I don't know if Underworld is, I don't necessarily want to get into the nitty-gritty of what is postmodern or what isn't. But, let's, you know, the sequence of events... No, that's not. The sequence of events is pretty simple, like, and laid out. Like, it's not really confusion about the sequence of events in Underworld that makes, you know, the past makes things difficult to kind of like talk about or contextualize. There's another layer of confusion on top of like the sequence of events. I mean, you know, I think that like there's not too many mysteries of causality left in the novel at the end. So it's interesting to me, and it feels like it mirrors a little bit like this tension between like the postmodern and more sort of like classical ideas of like, you know, A plus B equals C, in that line by Nick. And it felt like a kind of, I don't know, it felt like a very sincere moment, you know, of looking at your past and feeling a little bit like you can't really circumscribe it. But then when you're talking, when you're honest with someone that you trust about it, giving them the kind of means to do that packaging that you can't do yourself.
Do you want me to read that section?
Yes, if you could.
I found the passage you're referring to. Let's see. When I tell her things, she listens with a high, clear alertness, so vigilant and still, and she seems to know what I'm going to say before I say it. I tell her about the time I spent in correction and why they put me there, and she seems to know it at some level already. She looks at me as if I were 17. She sees me at 17. We take long walks along the drainage canal. All the hints and intimations, all the things she spied in me at the beginning of our time together, come to some completion now. If not for me, then for her. Because I don't know what happened, do I?
That's exactly it. Does that resonate with you, like in terms of that larger question, or where were you going to take that?
Well, I mean, I think that one thing that we keep coming back to in discussing this novel is the knowability of history, right? The extent to which what happened can be known, or the meaning of what happened can be known. In our discussion of the second section that we read, I talked then about the ways in which the underworld and the image of waste kind of represent the little day-to-day fine details of events of history, right? And how those things like the exact details of what happened to the ball to get it to where it ended up, things like the identity of the Texas highway killer, how those things are, the kind of big mythical things that spring from those are in some way inexplicable because the fine details of kind of the mundane life that underpin them are unknowable, right? Unrecorded. And the section that the line that you looked at, right? I don't know what happened, suggests, I think, even a greater level of inexplicability and unknowability, right? Because the only person who could know what happened is, in fact, Nick, right? He was there and he did the thing. And even he doesn't really know what happened, which I suppose even a little bit further complicates that thesis, right? It complicates even further the idea that anything is really knowable or explicable in a way. But at the same time, there is a... Even though to him the nature of the thing is inexplicable, there's still something that he gains and that she gains from him being as as open, as honest as possible about him kind of giving the memory of the thing in the clearest, most honest way that he can, which is, I guess, an interesting, almost a paradox in a way, right? That, or maybe not a paradox, but a kind of way of reconciling with that awareness, right? That meaning and event, the meanings and events of history are maybe in some way unknowable, but there is still a benefit in engaging with them in the manner that they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, we kind of see another sort of a very tight example of Nick not understanding what has happened in the moment that it's happened, and that's when he shoots Monza in the head, right? Because there is this moment where he, like, Monza's showing Nick this shotgun that he found, and Nick points it at Monza, asks if it's loaded. Monza says no, and Nick pulls the trigger. And in the moment that he pulls the trigger, that moment is really blown up, and the moments following, with Nick really deeply examining like what made Monza say no, which is an unanswerable question at that point because Monza's dead. His face is sausage. What led Nick would maybe more interestingly, what led Nick to point the gun at Monza? What was that game? What was the game that they were playing? So even though the sequence of events is very, very clear, it's not, there's something underlying the sequence of events that is not clear, and it never will be. But I like that idea that it's not going to be clearer for him, but there is some positive process, some positive gain in talking about it with Marion that that is still not necessarily answering any of those unanswerable questions, but it's doing something.
Here's what I want to know about this climactic event. And I wonder if either of you have an answer. So, like, a lot of the times in like a philosophical argument, someone will make the distinction between something being theoretically true and something being practically true. So, like, we could prove something, we could argue that something is theoretically true without being able to know about it in practice, right? Like, so, you know, one book I read argued that morals are theoretically true, but if we can't know some of them in practice, then that's a problem. And then he goes on to argue that we can know some in practice. And I was wondering, so this is like what we have here is an example of a practical unknowability, right? Like, we're in the moment, you know, Manza is giving off this weird smile that Shay goes back and thinks about and is like wondering about, and like, it's very cryptic, it's very macabre, it's very interesting, like it was an image that stuck with me. And we just can't know about it. And I'm wondering if the novel or DeLillo or whoever is trying to draw that idea out and to make a more theoretical statement, or like saying history is per se unknowable, or more less robust, history is sometimes unknowable. Like, sometimes things are unknowable to us, but it's still important to talk about.
I think that's a pretty good, the very last thing that you said there is a, I think, a pretty good description of one theme that you can draw from this novel. Right? Sometimes things are unknowable to us, but they're still important to talk about. I mean, I think that many things that we do are in some way inexplicable, right? And every now and again, chance causes an inexplicable thing to become important. You know, if you're Nick and you're playing with this shotgun and you point it at somebody and you say, "Is it loaded?" and they say no, and you pull the trigger and it's not loaded, who knows why you did that, right? It's a momentary impulse whose motivations are unknowable. And the fact that you can't understand that thing won't matter because that thing is of no consequence.
Right.
But chance causes the thing to suddenly gain consequence, which means that an inexplicable thing becomes incredibly important while remaining at its core inexplicable because it, in the moment that it was done, it was intended to be a minor thing of no consequence, right? And so I think that, like, really burrowing into that event, I think, does suggest ways in which, because large history springs from essentially chance, the meaning of history, the whys of history, are in fact unknowable, right?
One criticism that I've read
of the ending of this book, or not the very ending with the nun in cyberspace, but the ending of the arrangement in gray and black section, there's a criticism that I've read that basically, like, that there's nothing that you learn in the accounting of that crime that's particularly surprising, right? But I think the unsurprisingness of it actually is thematically important, right? And it's another way that you could maybe read it as metafictional if you wanted to, because we are led to expect through our familiarity with the techniques of fiction that discovering the real truth of that moment will give us meaning and perspective and understanding. But then when you get there, you discover that there's some kind of irreducible unknowability where meaning and perspective and understanding can't really be drawn from the thing because it is, in fact, inexplicable whimsy chance that happens to be kind of swept into the larger current of history.
I find that a super interesting idea, especially because that idea is actually the basis for some arguments against human beings having free will. The fact that our motivations are not under our control, that they just come up out of, like, our, you know, the unconscious processes in our brain, just, you know, motivations just happen. Like, we don't control them. They're not knowable. Like, why should I suddenly, after years of, like, pursuing art or writing as really my only art form of interest, like, that I personally do, and then all of a sudden trying to get into making music, which happened to me, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. Like, why did that happen? And I have no answer for that. So I think that's a super interesting, like, if we're saying something that the novel is, like, trying to get at or trying to explore, I think it's interesting.
Is there, because, like, one, not to to hand it right back to you, Patrick, but one of your questions is about the characters and not really caring very much about the characters in Underworld. And it feels like there might be a relationship between honoring the sort of weight and the causal implications of randomness and unknowable, you know, unknowable aspects of history that kind of, like, it feels like that might take a little bit of space away from, like, individual agency and, you know, the characteristics of individual characters causing certain things to go in certain directions, because as things become more random or more unknowable, then it's maybe a little bit harder to create characters that are, you know, exercising specific wants and desires across, you know, a whole plot. Right. You know, like that. Does that make sense? Does that feel like...
I think it's
like,
a great, like, I think it's a great observation of, you know, like when we... Characters that don't have a strong sense of agency are, you know, that makes sense to me, that why we wouldn't necessarily, like, you know, just from, like, the more, like, let's call it the caveman aspect of being a reader, like, you're trained by, you know, Hollywood movies and everything else to, like, want characters who do things and want characters who you know, take fate into their own hands and all that. And so when you have characters that don't do that, who don't perform significant, like, real, I mean, who they perform significant actions, but they don't do it from motivations that they understand or control. And it may even be that we never control our motivations, like we were talking about. So I definitely think that's interesting. Really, you know, I asked that the question about, like, why don't I find these characters compelling? But in the back of my head, the main reason is, like, I always find large casts of characters to be difficult as a reader. From my earliest days as a reader, I found multiple viewpoint characters to be hard to handle, less interesting. And, like, I know you're saying, like, there's only, like, four or five. Like, how many viewpoint characters are there? I'm not sure. But, you know, really, like, one or two is tops for me, to be honest. Like, I know it's stupid, but it's just, it's a habit I can't seem to get out of.
One of the things that I was going to ask about, and this is a pretty minor thing, and I don't know how much juice there is to squeeze out of it, maybe a lot, maybe a little, but it was interesting to me that I think I might have even noted this in an earlier episode. Nick pretty much always gets to speak in first person, mm-hmm. right? All the other viewpoint characters are in third person. And Nick is almost always narrating in first person, which is an interesting effect, right? The switching into first person for him. It really kind of signposts him. It's maybe the only thing that signposts him as, like, the core
right.
protagonist slash viewpoint character, right? If it weren't for that technique, I don't even know that we would instinctively identify him as being any more important than Clara Sachs or Albert Bronzini right. or Nick Shea. Matt Shea, rather, his brother. But so it's interesting to me that in the arrangement in Gray and Black section, he doesn't get first person. He's just another viewpoint third person character, essentially one of four equals there, right? So I was just wondering, can we point to a why, and what effect does it have that our longtime first person narrator is reduced to a third person viewpoint in that final section, or penultimate section, I guess, because there's Das Kapital after that.
I wonder if it's, I feel like, is there, like, a craft reason, you know, as much as is it maybe harder to write about the impulses that drive, because, like, there's a couple scenes that I'm thinking of, like, having sex with Clara, and also shooting Monza. It feels like that third person distance gives more space for things that that first person might require explanation. I don't know.
I think that that might be, that's a good point. I like that. And you can probably tie that in with a thematic angle, right? Which is to say that perhaps in some basic way, he is living an unexamined life at this point. He is not thinking about why he does what he does. He's very unself-aware, very unself-analytical, in a way that he never is allowed to be again after this event, right?
It could also, I mean, and I think thematically, like, this is maybe a bit of apologia, but, like, it feels a bit like Nick would see the person that he was in third person, right? So, like, and maybe this is just a new way, a different way of saying the same thing. Like, yeah, like, he doesn't understand himself before that event. And I guess that puts a different way. This is why, like, I do want to, with suitable time away from it, reread the novel. But, like, the beginning when he meets with Clara again, this is like Clara is a bridge back to a self that he doesn't understand. Or doesn't, you know, he's irrevocably separated from. I feel like I've heard that description of the Holocaust. The Holocaust, like, breaks history. Like, there's a before and an after of the Holocaust. And, like, it feels like Manza is something like that for him and that that person that he was and that family that he was in prior to that. Is a completely separate, separate thing.
So, in some sense, then is perhaps the act of meeting Clara in the desert, is that a form of inciting incident to the extent that it sets off a chain of recollection that, I mean, in some ways, like the action of this novel is almost the action of recall, right? Almost everything in it is. There's not really any present tense action, or hardly any present tense action. The only present tense action is that of memory, and we have kind of both the individual memory of people and the kind of grand cultural memory of America, I suppose. And that encounter with Clara in the desert as something that spurs memory is perhaps a form of it, like pulls out a plug that's been holding something in, and everything kind of comes spilling out.
I like that. I think that you could even maybe say that, like, because I'm pretty sure when he goes to see Clara, he's already suspects that Brian and Marion are having an affair, and there's a kind of a sequence of events in the, like, present of the novel that, you know, it's not just driving him backward. There might be some things to unpack in his actions after seeing Clara that tie back to that.
Well, it's interesting the things that the novel chooses to focus on, right? Because in, as a lot of other people would probably write these characters and stories, the moment of Nick sitting his wife down and being like, look, I killed a dude when I was 17. I spent years in various forms of correction. I hung out on a Jesuit farm as an alternative to juvenile hall, right? Like that, I mean, just off the top of my head, this is a different medium, right? But if you think about, like, I don't know,
a Taylor Swift song? That would be a Taylor Swift song.
No, what I was going to say is, if you think about, like, in Mad Men, right, when Betty Draper discovers that her husband has been living under a false identity the whole time that she's known him. Like, it's not a totally dissimilar level of deceit and surprise, right? But in the TV show, like, that moment of discovery is kind of played for dramatic effect. And you have something that, in many, many, like, many writers would choose to stage that dramatic scene And instead, it's just kind of tossed off in a short, kind of a shortish paragraph, right? Even though it's like an incredibly key thing in the evolution of those characters' relationships. And it's easy to miss, to some extent, I think, the kind of dramatic, both the dramatic and thematic importance of it. Chris, you were wise enough to pick up on it and spotlight it, but I've read this novel a few times, and I never really thought about the depth of that paragraph because it's tossed off in such a short, quick, casual way where many other people would play that dramatic scene out in a much more vivid fashion. And I think that's one of the things, you know, you had asked Patrick, why is it that we don't, or you don't, and I don't really, I actually, why is it that we don't feel more emotional identification with these characters? Why is it we don't care about them in a classical fictional sense? Part of it is that exactly, right? Because DeLillo avoids staging things in a manner that would make us care about them. If we had several pages of, darling, I have something important that I've never told you before.
Right.
I don't know if we would, maybe we would or wouldn't care about the characters, but it would be a classic, it would be a more classically effective way of trying to make us care about those characters. Yeah.
Is that effective because it's different? And is it different because DeLillo would find writing about that boring? And I know that that's like an unfair question. It strikes me that like DeLillo at this point, you know, he's such a respected author that like he can kind of do whatever. So like it's kind of, I you know, like these questions about like craft, you know, and editing and, you know, like, you know, what is he trying to make this, or like, you know, how do you strengthen certain qualities and kill certain darlings to make the final piece more effective? That more effective piece of this, I wonder how much of a red herring that is when, like, it feels like, you know, at this point in DeLillo's career, when he can kind of decide what he wants to do, like, he just maybe finds that writing those types of scenes just boring. I don't know.
I remember we talked about this when we were all in the comedy class in grad school, where we read, I think, three or four different DeLillo novels. We talked about this in relationship to a scene in The Names where there's a fighting, there's a couple that are fighting in The Names, and there's this thing that is called the 27 depravities, where the man of the couple, the protagonist of that novel, James Axton, he makes a list of all the things that he thinks his wife would accuse him of and recites them to her as a way of kind of supercharging the argument while appearing to try to avoid it. And it's a very kind of funny human comic moment. And our professor at that time suggested that on some level, DeLillo almost does that. It's much more memorable in a human way than most of the rest of The Names, which is mostly very abstract and strange and inexplicable. And our professor, Eric Heine, suggested that DeLillo does those sorts of things every now and again as a way of saying, like, see, if I wanted to, I could, right? If I wanted to do this kind of human dramatic conflict in appealing ways that would make it easier to sell books, I would. But I want to do all this other stuff, you know? And I mean, I don't know how much of that is conscious, but I do think that the, you know, DeLillo is interested in theme, as he's interested in theme, and he's interested in symbol, and he's interested in ambiguous questions, right? Like those, and he's interested in prose level craft. Like, maybe if I really thought about it, I could wring out other things. But above all, I think he's a theme writer, he's a symbol writer, and he's a craft writer. He's like a play with sentences writer, you know, and almost everything else, including most of the things that people find traditionally appealing about novels, are just not that interesting to him, really. And if you think about that section, what does he focus on in our last 30 pages with Nick Shea, right? I had mentioned this last episode, but you have this, like, that image of nuclear bombs incinerating trash. Like, that is such a drawing together of the two main streams of imagery in the novel, right? Like the Cold War and trash. Like those are, those images come up over and over and over and over and over and over again. And then in the final section, they are in this very explicit way, kind of fused together and united. And I remember at the time, like before I reread this, I remember feeling clever for noticing that the two main images of the novel are united in that way. But in fact, he very, I think one of the characters, or I can't remember who, but somebody pretty explicitly says, the two main streams of history, trash and weapons, united together. It's the fusion of two streams of history, other, weapons and waste. Right. So like, it's not clever to notice that. It's actually signposted very clearly. Right. So there's kind of like the dramatic resolution of the character relationship is tossed off in a paragraph, and the symbolic resolution of the kind of the thematic resolution of this, the symbol relationship is burrowed into for pages and pages and pages. And that's, I think, like incredibly characteristic of how he operates, for better or worse. I mean, probably for worse for many people's views. But it's, I mean, I think like the kind of chutzpah involved in doing that and in being so blithely dismissive of most of what makes people want to read books and getting away with it, you know, there's a kind of, there's a romance to that that has always appealed to me.
That that nuclear detonation that incinerates all the toxic waste. I think if I remember right, there's not even really any sound, or it's nothing, right? Like they notice nothing, and so there's this weird callback to, because there's really three shots, right? Like there's the shot heard around the world, the home run. There's the shot heard around the world, the Soviet nuclear test. There's the shot that turns Gonza into a dead person. I was trying to be more clever, but I just decided to scale that back. And then there's this nuclear blast at the end that is underground. It's surrounded by a kind of like a party, like there's a party going on, and there's nothing, like it doesn't even shake the ground. I don't know if there's anything to that, but
well, it's concealed, right? It's happening out of sight in the same way that many of the significant events, character beats, so much of the novel is about us seeing as, so much of the novel is about exposing to us things that are significant that happen out of sight, right? The Texas highway killer, Marion having an affair with Brian and doing heroin, right? Like it's significant moments that are hidden from memory and history. And so the fact that this momentous thing, this giant release of forces, and this thing that is both, you know, kind of literally immensely powerful and conceptually very powerful for these signposted reasons, it's all buried out of sight. It happens underground, and it just kind of makes, you'd hardly know it's even there, right? Like that seems very so appropriate, it's almost too appropriate.
Yeah, it's funny. It just occurred to me. This is like the Funhouse mirror shit of DeLillo, where like you can't tell if it's on purpose or whether it's just like accidental. But like hearing you describe that, like another interesting aspect of the Nick Clara sexual liaison, you know, happening in third person rather than being told from Nick's perspective. It feels, it's not that it's anticlimactic, it's just that I didn't really know what to latch onto that, like, made that such a momentous thing for Nick, like, if that makes sense. And so it's interesting that we, you know, like, he has remembered her for decades, and then we get it, and it's I mean, it's interesting, but I didn't know how to complete that, you know, from his first person perspective back to the, you know, affair being, you know, described in third person. It felt like the two ends didn't connect in some way for me.
Well, and it might be that it's only significant to him because it's in such close proximity to this life-altering event, right? That it represents a kind of, I mean, there are some lines in the final section where he talks about how much he misses those kinds of rough, unexamined days, what he calls the days of disarray. And it might be that the only thing that really gives that affair with Clara the power to kind of shake so much loose from memory or to affect him the way that he does, that it does when he thinks about it later or encounters her later, it might be that it's just the proximity to that kind of break in history that gives it that quality, which is why, again, like seeing the real thing in real time has the same kind of anticlimactic quality that even seeing the actual murder does. I don't know if this is a question exactly, but it seems like I would hate to not at least note more significantly the museum, and I think it's called something like a museum of deformities, the many horrifyingly deformed disabled people who have had their genes horribly screwed up by the proximity to the nuclear testing.
There's a museum and a clinic, right? So the museum is like fetuses and the clinic is people actively being treated or cared for.
There's a museum and a clinic, and that scene is another culmination of something, right? Because it calls back to two things earlier in the novel. There's a scene where they watch, I think it's during the Cocksucker Blues section, they watch a lost, I looked this up and it is a fictional film. They watch a lost Fritz Lang film called Unterwelt, Underworld, right? That is about a scientist who develops a kind of a ray gun that when you shoot people with this ray gun makes them into bizarre deformed monsters. And there's also a section where Maddie Shea is talking with, when he's working as a scientist for the military, he's talking, there are rumors of entire villages and towns of, you know, deformed nuclear mutants. And that's treated as this kind of urban legend or this maybe this thing that might exist but might just kind of be invented. And then in the final section, it is kind of, it's there, right? And I suppose there's an ambiguity to that where is that something that is actually being kind of brought into the overground flow of history, or is Nick encountering something in person which is remaining hidden, is remaining in the underworld, and you know, still sitting outside of official record and known to almost nobody? I guess probably more the latter, right? But there's an interesting effect where this kind of image that has been myth or rumor or fiction is brought into the real text of the novel. And I don't know that I can pull any more meaning out of that that adds much to what we've already talked about, but I didn't remember that bit, right? I remembered, having read this a couple times, I remembered almost everything else that happens, but for some reason that didn't really lodge in my memory, and it was very striking on this reread.
Well, I mean, are they, who's the Russian, who's Victor? Victor is taking them on this tour. He's kind of dragging them along. And Victor is the one who makes the statement about weapons and waste, right? And basically, like, you know, are these people in that lens the waste byproducts of, I guess, like, even it doesn't have to be restricted to that lens. Like, they are the waste byproducts, or they're suffering the they're inextricably linked to the waste of the nuclear arms race. And so you know, I don't know. DeLillo, at some point, Patrick, I have to kind of come, like, circle back around to, I think, what I sense to be your frustration mm-hmm. with DeLillo, where a lot of the things that I feel like I'm doing to enjoy DeLillo feel like sort of like how Facebook monetizes itself. It feels like I'm working on behalf of the novel to make sense of things.
Sure.
That it doesn't really want to make sense of for me. I don't know. I start to get a little bit, as much fun as I have, I also get frustrated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, DeLillo has always been a frustrating read for me. You know, and I think your take on it, Chris, is like feeling like you have to do the work to make it enjoyable is probably a good enough description of my experience reading DeLillo. Like, I definitely don't think, I think that it, I definitely prefer when a writer is more transparent about their ideas, more willing to write interesting or at least you know, more willing to rely on plot, you know, more willing to write about things that happen, you know, just things happening, I guess. And, you know, a part of me thinks that on the one hand, like, it's with the, you know, like, trying to get a new reader as a writer is really hard. And that's with just having, you know, writing a basic genre book, you know, where, you know, you're just trying to tell a story and not necessarily trying to, like, have any weighty ideas or anything like that. So I would say I would want, like, DeLillo to do some, just a little bit more for us. But, you know, that's just me. Like, obviously Hans, you know, really digs DeLillo, so, like, it's enough for Hans and other fans. So, you know, he doesn't need me, right? He's successful.
Well, at this point, you've read several of his books.
I've been forced. I've been forced to read them.
You liked Cosmopolis.
It was all right.
Oh, Cosmopolis is. I'll say, like, I really had to rush through the last, like, bit of this novel to make it in time for this podcast, and I feel bad about that. I think I really want to return to it in a few years. And I think I would like it. I do have, like, one sort of, like, craft level irritation with this. Craft is the wrong way of putting it. I have one just sort of, like, irritation with this novel that I don't think that I'm going to get over, even as I kind of, like, I think that I will be able to, like, play in that space of ideas, but and enjoy this novel, in subsequent rereads if I get around to it. But I really don't think I'm going to enjoy how often the dialogue becomes DeLilloian, like people talking over each other dialogue. Like, it just does not, like, that I still remember that argument from the names Hans. And it sticks out in that novel like a gemstone. And here there's just so many more opportunities for people to have these conversations that are like really clipped with like two people like talking almost to themselves. And I just got tired of reading them. I got tired of them. And I don't like, you know, it might just be like a ratio thing where like, you know, you have very beautiful, you know, just beautiful. He's just a lovely writer. But like, you know, and his dialogue is excellent, but I just got really tired of those scenes with people talking and not listening to each other, not really.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
So defend him, Hans. No, I'm kidding.
Well, I mean, I think like what am I trying to say? I think, Patrick, to your point, you know, you said, well, he doesn't need you. I do think that it's not unreasonable to be a little annoyed when you have to repeatedly encounter something that you regard as overrated, right?
Sure.
You keep having this guy pushed into your face as kind of an avatar of literary greatness. And if you disagree with that, then it's reasonable to have a little bit of a bristling reaction to that, right? And I mean, I'm very prone myself to being furiously irritated by having to repeatedly hear about things I regard as overrated. So I mean, I think it's reasonable to have the annoyances that you do. And I certainly can't, as kind of like, I guess, the sort of token DeLillo stan on the podcast. I mean, I do think that a lot of people, probably more people, regard him as annoying and overrated than his reputation might suggest. You probably are not alone in that, you know. And even people who like him think that this novel probably needed some editing, right? I have no problem with any of it, right? I have absolutely no problem with this novel being completely what it is, and I would not want it to be edited. But I do think of that as something that is entirely a personal preference, right? I can't, you know, sometimes with a book like this, you might be able to come in and say, actually, here's all the great character development and interpersonal drama that you're missing. And it's not an argument like that where I'm going to come out and I can't make the argument that it actually is doing the things that you want novels to do. I don't know, Chris, you might or might not want to edit this depending how it goes, but I was just thinking, as you guys were talking, I was thinking about while I was in the swamps of Louisiana, I read a novel called Martyr by a first-time novelist named Kaveh Akbar. And I remember thinking as I read it, like, this is a very good novel in every kind of conventional sense, right? And it had this quality of being written by someone who completely understood and was entirely conscientious of all of the things that novels should do. And you could almost kind of feel him going, oop, here's the character development, and oop, I'm going to put this here, and oh, they'll pick up on it later, and oop, oh, a little bit of theme, like, oh, some theme, and oh, now the characters are having an important revelation about how they feel about each other. And you know, it was using all those techniques in such a correct way, right? And it was doing everything exactly the way that it was supposed to. And, you know, like you, if we covered it on this podcast, we could definitely point to exactly the things he was trying to say about prejudice and the Iranian American experience and the nature of art, and, you know, and the protagonist was the protagonist had all the same kind of identity niches as the author, so, you know, no boundaries being overstepped there. And it was so 100% correct in how it did everything, and it just, I don't know, it was so lifeless to me, right? And I don't know, like it's a socially important novel that's gotten I don't want to put it down, because it's fundamentally a very good novel doing exactly the work that novels are supposed to do, right? But there was something about the way in which it there was something that was kind of innervating to me about, like, having read a whole bunch of literary novels, there was something about the way in which it was doing exactly everything it was supposed to that I found exhausting. And it's funny, like I read the acknowledgement section at the end when I finished it, and at the very end of the acknowledgement section he says something like, and I'm quoting this from memory so I might distort it a bit, but he says something like, you know, and of course, like, the greatest acknowledgement to you, the reader, I know that your time and attention are valuable, and I have done my utmost to be conscientious about using them appropriately. And it was like, I felt guilty for not liking the novel, because that was such a nice thing for him to say. And also it was like, oh, that's part of the problem, you know? And I don't know, like, reading that and coming back to Underworld, I felt, I don't know, like, I'm so grateful that there's a space for weird, messy, imprecise, imperfect things like this that are carried along by kind of like the author's sheer enthusiasm for his own voice and for kind of esoteric things. And I can't pretend that it's perfect, but, you know, there's the it kind of is like a nuclear mutant of a novel with, you know, a giant forehead and no eyes. And I don't know. I love it on those terms, and I'm very happy that it exists.
I think that's a beautiful place to end it. Who's next?
Patrick, I think?
No, Hans. You're always after. I have a pick if you want me to pick, but you're always after Chris, Hans.
Well, I was actually going to ask about something, and this relates to what your next pick might be, okay. Patrick. So, Chris, basically, like, we just did a three-part on a long book that Chris chose, right? And I've been thinking about rereading, like, since I reread Born and really enjoyed it, I've been thinking about rereading the Southern Reach trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer. Mm-hmm. Which inspired the movie Annihilation. And I love the movie Annihilation. I love Bourne. And I was completely underwhelmed and confused by the Southern Reach trilogy. And I've thought for a while that it might be interesting to read and discuss it with you guys. But it's essentially a chunk of text equivalent to Underworld. And it would probably be more interesting to read each book and talk about it than to read the whole trilogy and try to kind of encapsulate it all in one conversation. So I was thinking about doing essentially like another version of what we did with this, but I wanted to run that by you because that really like suggests that you also get your own giant work that we do over three or four parts, right? And so anyway, yeah, like I would be interested in doing the same thing with that trilogy, but I wanted to make sure that you knew that you also, I would at least be fine with you having your turn to kind of do a giant multi-part thing.
And by you mean me, since I'd be the only one who wouldn't have done it yet.
You would be the only one who wouldn't have done it. Yeah, exactly. And you wouldn't have to, obviously, like, it wouldn't have to be the next
right,
thing
I could,
after Southern Reach.
I could pick.
But I just want to say, like, if you guys are okay with me having, if you guys are okay with me saying, like, now let's do Southern Reach as a three-parter, I would want you to be thinking about what your multi-part thing could be, you know?
I am perfectly happy to read Southern Reach as a three-parter, and I am perfectly happy at some point to pick a long one and do in three parts. I have had a pick in the back of my mind that would fill that bill, though the next pick I think I'll pick is going to be a single episode one. But absolutely, let's do Southern Reach, and then at some point I'll do a big one.
All right, Southern Reach in three parts.
All right, cool.
All right, talk to you guys.
Peace.
Oh, what? Thank you guys for listening to this three-parter on Underworld, and next we'll be reading Southern Reach, which I think begins with Annihilation. So thank you for joining us.
All right.
Bye.
Bye, guys.